Hello, I'm Dr. Amalia Gonyas-Malka. Welcome to Womanity, Woman in Unity, the show that celebrates women's milestone achievements in their struggle for liberation, self-emancipation, human rights, democracy, and much more. Today, we're joined by Dr. Adeline Esterhazen, who is an obstetrician and gynecologist with special interests in obstetrics, urogynecology, and laparoscopic surgery. She is passionate about advancing women's health, particularly in areas like pelvic floor disorders, endometriosis, and fertility. She's known for her patient-centered approach, prioritizing conservative treatment before surgery. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
To begin with, can you explain the difference between obstetrics and gynecology for our listeners, and also how these two fields work together to support women's health?
Obstetric is looking at pregnant patients, looking after the mom, her health, as well as that of the baby, and then basically getting to the delivery and also the 6 weeks postpartum part. And gynecology is looking at all the other female health things, general, well, not the general health, but I mean the general gyne part of things, like screening for cervical cancer, dealing with pathology like endometriosis, different types of cancers, abnormal bleeding, contraception, you know, like you say, the pelvic floor abnormalities and restoration of it. So yeah, that would be all the other things not involved with childbearing.
Thank you for that, because often we see these phrases, obstetrics and gynecology, and I think it's great to give a really simple explanation. Tell us about some of the things that you find rewarding about the work that you do.
Oh, I don't know where to start. Like just for instance, looking at today, I had to deliver a baby of a diabetic patient, and marvelous women, but with so many comorbidities, such a high risk pregnancy. I basically prayed until we just got to 37 weeks, and to deliver that little baby, and to know that if we did well, you know, we got baby is a bit big for the age, because we didn't manage to control the diabetes perfectly. But that's not, you know, despite our best efforts, that's what happened there. But I mean, looking at that little face, I remember when I delivered my first baby. I always loved surgery, but when I delivered my first baby, that's when I fell in love with obs and gyne. It's just such a marvelous field, very rewarding in so many contexts, you know, especially the obstetric part, delivering the babies, but even then the gynecology part, just after I operated, doing laparoscope surgery, which is always so much fun. It feels a little bit like a PlayStation, you know, because you operate in the abdomen looking at a little screen, and it's a patient with secondary infertility, meaning that she had a baby 13 years ago, never felt pregnant again, but she has a partner now, would like to have a baby, you know, with her, and I had to go in and look for an abnormality, and I found that she had tubal pathology, so I was able to diagnose the tubal pathology firstly, and find out, oh, finally we know what's happening, and then to restore the anatomy for her to be able to fall pregnant. So I'm sure I'll see her very soon, being pregnant and managing that pregnancy and delivering that little baby, and walking around in Amanas where I work, and to look at all these little faces that I delivered. It's a wonderful upbeat part of medicine. It is typically, I always said, I'm not very fond of sick people, in the sense that my people are not, they do tend to get sick, but it's acute medicine. So if they get sick, I fix a little thing and they're fine again. Whereas with internal medicine or general medicine, it is more chronic thing, which I'm not very fond of. So in my field, it's just very upbeat and high volume, it's fast-paced, very fast-paced, which I enjoy. I get bored. So you can't get bored in obs and gyne, not at all.
It sounds like every day is different. And
absolutely.
The idea that you're bringing life into this world, that must
exactly.
be an amazing feeling.
Exactly. It's humbling and rewarding at the same time, you know, to know I was just an instrument, you know, if anyone is religious, I mean, I'm a Christian, and to know that I was an instrument of God to be able to be part of that woman's journey and that little being born. My hardest pregnancies by far it's a very high stress environment, but by far the most rewarding. Like my little godchild that I showed you now, I mean, his mom developed preeclampsia, which I knew she would. I mean, we do risk analysis way in the beginning of pregnancy, and I knew she's a very high risk patient to develop preeclampsia. I tried to prevent it, didn't work, so we had to remove her baby or deliver. Remove sounds horrible. Deliver her baby at 32 weeks at 1.4 kilos. He was so teeny tiny, and just to be able to see how he's growing into this amazing individual. It's just fabulous.
You've got a great job, but it took a long time for you to get to where you are. I read an article which mentioned that it took 16 years of pursuing your dream to eventually specialize in your field, and that just speaks resilience. It speaks perseverance. Tell us a little bit more about that journey.
So it takes, when I did my studies, it took 6 years to get to my MBCHB, at which point you're a general practitioner. Then we had to do 2 years of internship, for which I'm very grateful. I was the first group to be enrolled into the 2 years instead of the 1 year, because to be honest with you, when I was a student, I hated ops and gynae. I didn't like the high stress environment back then. I think it was just a bit overwhelming as well as a student, and everyone is yelling at you the whole time. And now I understand it, now that I'm an obstetrician myself, and if something small goes wrong, it can have a big impact. So I understand now why my superiors at that point were so, I don't know what to call them. It was just not a very nice environment. But anyway, so 6 years of MBCHB, 2 years of internship, 1 year of community service. So that's the 9 years. Then I had to apply to a specialist post. There were 30 applicants for three posts, and I succeeded to get one. And then it's 4 years of specialization. But because I had gone through a bit of hardship, heartbreak, in fact, I had to do an additional year. I had to take a bit of time off and work through some stuff. And but because my professors acknowledged my skill and had faith in me, they reinstituted me, and I could finish my degree. So I'm very grateful to them. Amazing. I studied at the University of Pretoria, and they were just so they sheltered me a bit. They understood what I went through at that point, and they carried me. And then eventually I finished in 2016 and came to Hermanus February 2017, opening my private practice here, because again, God provides. And I just got a call out of the blue during my final year, and they wanted to know if I wanted to come and work here, do deliveries in Hermanus. And I just thought for 2 minutes, 2 seconds, not 2 minutes, 2 seconds. I was like, absolutely, this sounds like the brilliant plan. So for 5 years, they were looking for an ONG year, and here I am.
What an amazing story. And your environment is very special.
Exquisite. It's a bit challenging in the sense that it's about 2 hours drive, depending on the traffic and all, going over the mountain, as everyone calls it here, to Cape Town for I'm so grateful for webinars. Thank you, COVID. So thank God for that. But if you have to go through for an person attendance, that's a bit of a mission, or going over to Vageligen, which is in Somerset West, to learn additional skills, which is something I'd like to do. I want to learn how to do laparoscopic hysterectomies, for instance. And I do have a laparoscope trainer, but it's different doing that than working on patients. So you have to sacrifice a bit in and push yourself a bit different from the guys in the city who can have easier access to learn, but it's not impossible. On the other hand, I have this beautiful nature. I'm a big nature lover, so being able to have a view over the sea and the mountains and go strolling in the mountains whenever, or on the beach, it's just marvelous living here.
Yes, and I have to say, looking through your window from where I'm sitting, I am a little envious. So you started your practice in 2017, and it's a private practice. Tell us about some of the common concerns or conditions that women present with, and also in line with that question, if there's anything that's less common but important, and things that you think women should know about.
So Hermanus does have a bit of an older community, for which I'm happy to serve. It's wonderful sounds horrible because I don't want anyone to be sick, but I mean, I see a lot of pelvic floor pathology, which, as you know, it's one of my passions. It's just such a rewarding part of gynae surgery because it's not life saving, but it's a quality of life enhancing. So many older ladies that present with bladder prolapse or rectal prolapse or even uterine prolapse, and it's not exactly dinner conversation, so they don't know it's not normal. Having had normal deliveries, that's the biggest for having these issues. It is normal vaginal delivery, especially after assisted delivery or large babies, but there are other causes as well. But then to educate these ladies on this is not normal and you're not alone and I can fix it, and in being able to do that is something I see quite often here. And then quite a bit of endometriosis, and it does go undiagnosed many times. The incidence statistically should be between 10 and 14%, but that is like definitely conservative numbers in the sense of it doesn't always get reported, and patients don't always present to doctors, and it does get underdiagnosed if you don't go and properly investigate and end up doing a laparoscopy, which is the golden standard for diagnosing endometriosis. It doesn't get diagnosed. So I do see quite a few females with that. Some endometrial cancers, ovarian cancer, fertility, lots and lots of fertility issues that I try to sort out, but that does get a bit expensive. And I tend to refer them, it's about the expense, but also the expertise that they did. I refer them to the fertility unit in Stellenbosch mainly. And then, of course, my obstetrics, which is the whole range, you know, from low risk to high risk obstetrics and doing normal deliveries, assisted deliveries, cesarean sections. All should be. We do have a little neonatal ICU with two beds, so we're not completely on the same level as the guys in the city, but we do manage to do ba babies to look after babies on CPAP, like my baby of today, having to have positive ventilation.
I mean, you work across the spectrum, across cultures, across conditions. I want to ask a couple of deeper questions on some of those elements. So, for instance, from an endometriosis point of view, what are some of the things that women should look out for, and how do they manage that condition?
So, I always tell patients that they are blessed with a doctor with issues. Personally, I have endometriosis as well. So that's one of the reasons why I know a bit more about it, I guess. But it's such a debilitating disease if you don't look after it well. So the typical presentation of endometriosis is heavy bleeding, heavy and or prolonged, but they tend to be heavy with clots and exceptionally painful bleeding. It's very few patients that you will meet that don't have the combination of that. And then it can also escalate to where you have pain when urinating, especially when you have your period. So pain when urinating or passing stool, bowel changes, it can happen when someone doesn't have endometriosis either, to have the change in bowel habits, but it is excruciating. I always, like I said, I can relate to patients, and they feel so relieved if someone can tell them. It feels like someone is pushing a knife into you. It's like a sharp pain, and then shoving it around, because that's exactly what it feels like. Sex can become painful, typically also a sharp pain or pain afterwards, where the tummy even get bloated because the bowel is so irritated, because it's a disease that can infiltrate the bowel. It tends to go into the rectum. Then we have to do rectal shaving, or sometimes even a segmental resection of the rectum and reanastomosis if it gets bad enough. It can spread to the nose even. We have nosebleeds every month. It can spread to your lungs. I had one patient in the government sector in Pretoria who had a where she had a blood collection in the lung cavity. So it can really spread anywhere, and if you leave it for long enough, then it can cause chronic pain. Even if you resect all the endometriosis, it causes chronic pain because of the automated nervous system that gets triggered. So the management, what you asked about is firstly medical management. So I tend to be conservative first and see if I have a speculation or a clinical diagnosis of endometriosis, and there isn't a massive endometrioma, which is endometriosis of the ovary, if there isn't something on the sonar that convinces me we have to go for surgery first, then I try the conservative approach first, which unfortunately is hormones. I know people have all these bad ideas about hormones, but if you don't suppress it hormonally, because it's a hormonal dependent disease, estrogen dependent. So if you don't suppress it with hormones, there's really little else. There are lifestyle things. I do believe personally that if you follow a organic antioxidant diet, mostly veggie-based diet, Mediterranean type of diet, then your symptoms, it does get better. I've tried it myself. If I can just manage sticking to it, no alcohol, little caffeine, basically just healthy living, you do minimize the symptoms. But if you want to completely suppress the symptoms, it is by taking hormones. The contraceptive pill is one, taking Vizan, which is specifically manufactured, which is a type of progestogen. And then there's other sorts of stuff that can completely knock out all your hormones, but I never use that. And then if that doesn't work, we move over to surgery.
Thanks for walking us through that and also highlighting that it's not just a condition that affects the uterus or the womb, that it can actually spread to other parts of the body. Then you were talking about prolapsed uteruses for older women, and you'd mentioned this aspect of if they'd had natural deliveries. And it got me thinking, is there anything that women should be doing after delivery to kind of prevent these types of conditions or concerns happening down the line in later life?
Actually, it's something that they can do before delivery, in all honesty. We can't help for large babies to some extent if one prevents being obese or eating too much in pregnancy, gaining too much weight in pregnancy, that has some influence. But for a genetically large baby, there's not much we can do about that. Or if a baby lies in a different position, making labor like a occipital posterior position, making labor harder, and for which we typically need to do an assisted delivery. Those things is unfortunate, and it's not something that the mom can help for. But I recently had a patient who used an epi. Oh, I can't remember that name now, but it is basically a balloon that she used to stretch the vaginal canal in order to prevent this from happening. And I must say, she delivered within 3 hours. That's my first experience with this. So apparently something they use in England, which I want to implement in my practice. But then they can, because it was her first baby, and gradually stretched the vaginal canal, delivered a 3.9 kilogram baby within 3 hours with a very teeny tiny episiotomy. So I think with her, the chances are smaller, slimmer to get to a prolapse organs. But essentially, if we have a fit, not everyone has to do that. If you have a patient who is fit, keep on exercising, and massaging the perineum is something that they can try to stretch those muscles so that it's not these stiff muscles that a baby needs to try and push through. So there is some merit in that to try and prevent injury in the first place.
And the other aspect is to be talking about these things so people don't think that what they're going through is normal and that's how life is, that these conditions can be treated. And then the third point was the fertility aspect, which I mean, it's such a deeply personal and sometimes it can be a really challenging journey. Can you tell us about some of the advancements or options that are now available to women who are facing fertility issues? And I'm going to say this also from almost from an older point of view, because we've definitely seen that there's kind of like been a delay in terms of women getting married, a delay in women falling pregnant because they're developing their careers, they're becoming economically stable before they embark on supporting a family.
Exactly that. So that is our biggest problem that we see with fertility as older moms. It's a myth that the pill, taking the pill for a prolonged time, takes away your fertility. It's not that. It's not because you've been on the pill for 15 years. It's because you've waited for 15 years before trying to fall pregnant. So, statistically, after the age of 35, our chances of successful fertility or a successful pregnancy falls dramatically. According to Dr. van Waart's unit in Stellenbosch, they've done studies showing that falling pregnant after the age of 40 spontaneously is less than 1%. So I do encounter my patients. The one that I did the caesar on today was 41 years old and morbidly obese, but she still managed to fall pregnant. So you do get the exception, but the biggest issue with fertility is actually advanced maternal age, and then the next one in line is tubal factors. Unfortunately, and that's the other thing where sex ed comes in. Unfortunately, most of the time it is due to sexually transmittable diseases, for instance, chlamydia, that damages the fallopian tube, and then the eggs can't get into the fallopian tube and into the uterus. The next one in line is probably then endometriosis, which causes the same thing, also causes damage to the tubes and even the ovarian reserve. And then surprisingly, I would say the next in line is the male factor. Many of my patients, unfortunately, there's either no or minimal no sperm, or the sperm is there, but they are abnormally formed. And in that regard, the only thing that we can do, well, if you have few swimmers, we can go for either IVF or ICSI, most likely ICSI, which means intracellular injection. So we then under a microscope, we choose the strongest swimmer and we inject it into the egg under a microscope. It's fascinating. But ideally, you actually want a more normal conception. IVF is the superior one of those two then. Tubal factors, we can try and operate like I did today, open the tube and then hope the tube still works well because I don't know about the microanatomy, and then hope that it's not a tubal pregnancy. But yeah, so those are the biggest issues, and much of it is lifestyle related. We also see an increase in polycystic ovarian syndrome and endometriosis, which in a part is genetic, but in a big part is also lifestyle. Again, eating healthily, exercising, trying to avoid fast foods and overprocessed foods and alcohol, and just being active in general. It has a massive impact on these two diseases, and even the sperm or spermatozoa health. So, and with, I don't know about microplastics as well. I'll have to read up on that a bit, but I do think it must have an impact as well.
Yeah, we were exposed to conversation on microplastics a couple of weeks ago, and it was fascinating again on how these contaminants are everywhere. And just thinking about bottles of water and that we consume plastics
And I think
regularly.
people forget, I don't know if people forget that we're not separate from nature. We are part of nature. And anything that affects it, that is why if you don't live in rhythm with nature, these things are going to happen.
You're in private practice and you've got access to fantastic tools. Your patients come through, they can afford these types of interventions that come into play. But at the same time, when you were undergoing your internships, you were obviously appointed to different locations in under-resourced areas. So thinking about some of the things that you've mentioned now, how does an everyday woman living in a township pay attention or know that something is wrong? And what should she do and where should she go?
Yeah, I have such a soft spot for the government sector, and I actually reached out recently to Armonis Provincial to see if I can get involved there. I'm still waiting. They want to implement where we can also have an outreach kind of program there where we can help there. But it is hard because the problem is in the government sector that the medicine is good. I mean, the access or the doctors' training and the nurses, it's all good and we want to help, but the numbers are just so devastating. I remember at Kalafong Hospital, we used to see 120 patients on a day, on a Tuesday, and I had to do 50 to 70 sonars per day. It is just devastating, the kind of numbers you see. So that is why some people will never have access to help, just because of the sheer numbers. And then the other thing is maybe like you mentioned now, the education. Some people bleed 8 days, 9 days with clots the period, they think it's normal until they eventually arrive at the hospital with an HB of 3 and wonder why they're fainting. So I think it's also about education. I must say, I don't know how we're going to reach all of them to understand these things are not normal. That is quite a challenge. I don't know. But that is a big passion of mine, to be able to help the hordes. I would really love to be able to do that.
Look, I think education, whether it's formal, whether it's informal, is vital, because if you don't know, you just don't know.
That's it. They live with this pain and bleeding, just thinking, oh, well, that's just life. And then they eventually rock up at the hospital with heart failure.
Tragic.
I've seen that. I've admitted patients with multifibroid uteruses, which happens to be more prevalent in African patients. Multifibroid uterus with abnormal bleeding, and then having to do blood transfusions. And thankfully, the woman survives, but it has devastating consequences to their health.
Dr. Stazen, we are coming to the latter part of the show, and one of the questions that I ask all my guests is about some of the factors that they feel have contributed to their success. So people will talk about perhaps another person in their life, or values, or faith, or discipline, and everybody has a different recipe. So if you could please share with us what you feel have been some of your drivers of success.
Well, I think I'm just too stubborn to give up. So, it's been hard, and sometimes, well, many times, I wish I could do it all over. There were some hardships, and like I said, I went through a bit of a difficult patch during my specialization period, where Professor Lindeke, in particular, was a big rock, and one of my favorite people in the world, Dr. Pietro Mulder, she was my mentor at Kalafong Hospital, and they were just there to push me back up and to and prop me back up. So I had marvelous mentors, Dr. Ntlhari. It's just all these people who so knowledgeable but also so humble, and they made me hungry to learn more, and in particular not only not academically, but the compassion and the empathy and the zest they tackled everything with, and also the composure. I tend to be honest, I tend to become a bit emotional and a bit hot-headed, but to be able to do it with composure and sensibility, to approach things sensibly. No, I've had quite a few good mentors in Pretoria University, and basically, like I said, too stubborn to give up.
It can be a good trait. And thinking about the way that your professors were with you, that we don't live in a cookie cutter solution environment, that it wasn't a case of, okay, Adeline, if you're not sticking with the program, get out. It was a case of saying, we recognize your potential. We know that you're going through a rough patch, but we're going to support you because we know where you can go.
And for that, I'm eternally grateful, because if you go through something bad and you stop believing in yourself, where you want to get, you're just not entirely sure how, and you just lose all faith in yourself. You need these people to remind you who you are, and if they have faith in you, then surely you can get there. And that is basically what I needed and what pulled me through.
Oh, good success story. And in line with this journey, tell us about some of the pivotal moments in your life growing up that had an impact on you.
Well, when my mom says since I could walk and talk, I wanted to be a doctor, I didn't know about that. Although I used to dissect organs when my dad went hunting, I would dissect the hearts and kidneys. I loved looking at it, and I think I had my parents worried at some point, but I always loved loved medicine and looking at these different things. So that was definitely one of the biggest part of my upbringing, is being able to partially grow up in the bush and learn about the wild, and I know all the antelope and their behavior and all of that. It's lovely. Like the Kruger doesn't faze me. It's too commercialized for me. I don't like that. And then when we moved to Frey Freiburg. I don't even know how to pronounce that in English. Freiburg. I don't know. But my dad ventured into farming. So that was something that, having to go from Joburg to there in this very rural environment, we it felt like a step back in life. And after a year of that, we lost everything. We returned to Johannesburg with, I remember my dad said, with 2,000 rand and our bakkie and the clothes on our back. That's it. And we had a dog as well. So we all returned to Joburg, and from there my dad worked his way all the way up again from nothing to and working as a financial advisor to be able to put me through tertiary education, me and my sister through school, and then me through tertiary education. And I'm in awe of my father and my mom, who was always stood by him and doing his administration and even starting a little cafeteria in the middle of nowhere to try and sustain us living in the Northern Cape. And eventually, yeah, like I said, we came back. I went through my tertiary education, and I just went from strength to strength. People always ask me, but how did I decide to do this, and how did I even get to Hermanus? And it's really literally by God's grace. I plan a little bit ahead. I mean, I knew I wanted to be a doctor, and eventually realized I definitely want to be an ONG. But living in Hermanus is really by God's grace. And having a successful practice. And Palesa Kennedy, my colleague that I pulled in from Johannesburg, what an incredible woman. And I was sitting in Tanzania. I so desperately wanted to see the Serengeti. So I went there 2 years ago, and I was sitting there thinking, what is making me so miserable? Because at that point, I was in private alone, working 24/7. In a sense, I was on call 24/7, and no one can do that. You get so tired. Even though I love my job, I got emotionally exhausted. You can't even go to the bathroom without your phone. So I was sitting there thinking, what can I do to change this? And I realized, you know what? I need a colleague. And I was sitting there thinking, I want a female colleague, but I want someone of color, because we were just a little pod here with a lot of whites. It's just weird. No doctor of color in our unit. And I want a black female in my unit. And I was praying a bit, and I messaged this one woman in Space Care, Space Net, sorry, that I know is also a woman of God. And I was like, Deborah, do you perhaps know of someone who would like to come and join me? And she said, you know what, I'll see, I'll just what's it, fingertips uitsteek. She'll inquire and she'll find out. And 5 minutes later, Palesa messaged me. And it's just basically a love story from there. We're like ebony and ivory, here we go. And it's just, what, of all people in South Africa, that's the woman that came to Hermanus. Vibrant, full of energy, passionate, wants the same things that I do. We both want to push this lab scope thing, passion for her patients. She's just amazing. So, yeah, God's grace.
There's a expression, I think it's Aristotle, and it's something about the sum of I'm going to get it wrong. I'm going to have to probably edit this, but it's words to the effect of the whole is greater than the sum of the parts. So by the two of you coming together, it's not 1 + 1 = 2, but it could be 25 because of
Exactly.
your connections and the way that you build off of one another and have this development.
So I'm very excited. I'm very excited about this hospital. I was the only ONG. We did have a GP here doing deliveries, but I was the only ONG for 7 years. And then we also had Dr. de Vlaeminck doing gynae, but it was this fragmented situation, right? And we didn't even have a neonatal ICU facility where we could at least support babies who needed extra ventilation. And since the time I've gotten here, we managed to build this hospital to incorporate two neonatal ICU beds. And we're going to expand it to have a whole maternity wing. That's what we want to aim for. And may hopefully pull in more ONGs. So, yeah, we have big dreams.
Well, you've got these wonderful aspirations for growth. And while we're on this note, please talk about why women who are looking at a specialization in their medical career should follow the obstetrics and gynecology route.
Well, I'll be honest, sometimes I do wonder if I made the right decision in the sense that I'm not married. There are ONGs who get married, that is definitely a thing, and they do get kids. I tried, I had a failed IVF, again, a doctor with issues, so I know what that feels like. But It's an all-consuming career. That is one thing I can say. It's not a career, it's a lifestyle. And for a woman in that regard, it is a bit tough. I'm sure it is in a way possible to juggle having a family and doing my job, but it is not easy. Something's got to give, and it can't be your job because people's gonna die. So in that regard, I love my job. It is an extremely rewarding job, but one does need to be careful about your choices of having a family. My assistant in theatre, for instance, she's a lovely girl, considered specializing. I think she did a year of specialization in ONG, and then she decided, or she realized, it is going to be too tough on her family to do it. So that's the one thing I must say about ONG. It's all consuming, very rewarding, but to be strongly considered, or maybe reconsidered if you want to have a family life.
I think it's about you, how you want to do the job and how you want to ensure that, because you've got such an empathetic and compassionate aspect about you, that you really care about the people that your patients. Whereas, some people may be a little bit factory minded, and it's a run of the mill. So
Perhaps.
You definitely have the sense about you of caring for everyone that you serve. And lastly, as we close out today's conversation, please share a few words of inspiration or motivation for young women that are listening to us.
Don't give up. It might seem impossible, and you might think that you can't man up to the job, but you can. You can always do more than you think you can. I mean, if I could beat in anorexia, and I could beat depression and anxiety and lots of heartache and loss, and eventually get here, and I'm so fulfilled and happy, and I just pushed through all of that somehow, and I got here. So just don't give up.
Powerful message. Don't give up. Thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate your time and understanding the wonderful work that you do.
Thank you.
You have been listening to Womanity, Woman in Unity, and we have been talking to Dr. Adeline Esterhazen, who is an obstetrician and gynecologist based in Hermanus, South Africa.